Europe is a peace project. Following an eternity of war, Europe's nations decided to put their differences behind them and peacefully unite.
It must be all for all. We cannot aim at anything less than the union of Europe as a whole. And we look forward with confidence to the day when that union will be achieved.
Prosperity and togetherness would now trump war and strife. It's the European story. But is it a myth? That's the question we're asking on this episode of the Another Europe is Possible podcast with Luke Cooper from Anglia Ruskin University. On today's show, we're joined by Yale historian Timothy Snyder, whose recent book, Road to Unfreedom, takes apart the European myth and insists there's a bigger story that Europe should be telling. It's what states can do when their empires die. To feed back to us on today's podcast, you can get us on Twitter at @another_Europe, and you can also get us on facebook.com/AnotherEuropeIsPossible. Hope you enjoy it.
So, Tim, welcome to the show. Where do you think the idea of Europe has gone wrong? The story of Europe has been mistaken. This is something that you've been really keen to criticise by incorporating the role of empire. So tell us a little bit about it to kick us off.
So I guess for me, the European Union is fascinating in its mythology because it's an entity which presents itself as being above mythology, beyond mythology. It generally legitimates itself in these purely rational terms. So we allow people to do what they already want to do. We enable people to have the kinds of businesses and lives that they want to have. We prevent bad things. So you don't have to have any kind of complicated metaphysics to think that war is a bad thing. So we prevent bad things, but we don't really have much of a story. We don't really exist in a metaphysical realm. That's the European myth, right? The myth is a kind of anti-myth. But even so, it's still completely not true. It's just as not true as all the other myths. The funny thing about the European myth is that rather than being an entity that's purely rational, rather than having no story except a story of success, what the European Union really has is a myth that is parasitical upon other myths. And the myth that it's parasitical upon is the national myth. And this is where we have to sort of take a minute, because now we're talking about the things that everybody takes for granted, which aren't true. So the national myth, which is not true, is that there are nations in Europe that have long histories, and in that history, they've generally had states, and those nation states have been around with us, and they've had experiences and made decisions. That's something that's so deeply under the skin, I mean, in the bones of Europeans, that you can't really challenge it. People might be critical of their nation, they often are, but the idea that there are nation states that are out there and they've been out there for a long time is very hard to challenge. But it's just not true. What's actually true and what's much more interesting and much more useful if one's trying to understand what's going to happen or predict what's going to happen next is that the history of Europe is actually a history of empires. That's what the history of Europe is. The modern history of Europe, whether it's Britain or France, or for that matter, in a different way, Germany or Italy or even Belgium, the Netherlands, certainly, Italy, Russia, is a history of empires. And so what the European Union does is that it allows that myth of the nation state to survive in a different form. Because what the European Union says is that, oh yes, our nation states were naughty for a long time, and then they learned, and now our nation states are nice. But that's not true. There weren't nation states, not really, not in the big important countries. They were empires.
Let's expand and draw this out a little bit. Can you tell us a bit more about how we get from empire to the EU?
What really happened, which is much more interesting, and it actually makes the achievement of the European Union much more interesting, is that these European empires, which controlled the world, stopped controlling the world, broke up, were defeated, fought bloody colonial wars, right? It's not true that Europeans learned from the Second World War not to fight wars. That's simply false. It's simply false. Everyone says it over and over again, but it's simply false. The British kept on fighting, the French kept on fighting, the Dutch kept on fighting. They kept on fighting as long as they could until they were humiliated and defeated. Whether it was in Algeria or Suez or somewhere else, they kept on fighting as long as they could. The idea that Europeans didn't fight wars after the Second World War is just not true. They kept fighting imperial wars as long as they could. And then when they couldn't any longer, Europe was there for them.
So what does that look like exactly? How do we define this new Europe, which is being born in the ashes of empire in the post-war period?
The essential thing about the European Union is that it solves a problem which has been in human history from the beginning, like since Mesopotamia, which is, what do you do after empire? Right? There's a standard story of empire, and the standard story of empire ends with the barbarians at the gates taking everything that you care about, right? And what the European Union does is that it changes that story for the first time. For the first time in history, you get to lose your empires, but you don't lose everything. In fact, you get this nice soft landing at the end of it where you basically preserve your standard of living, even though you fought the First World War, even though you fought the Second World War, even though you lost your world empire. At the end of it, you cheat history and you maintain your standard of living. You actually end up with collectively probably the best lifestyle, not only in the world, but in the history of the world. You get that despite the fact that you've lost empire. But that's the story which is not told. What the European Union does is that it takes the myth of the nation, which everyone likes, and it raises it to a slightly higher level. Now, why is that so dangerous? If you don't know why you've been successful, then it's unlikely you'll continue to be successful. So what the European Union did is that it took fragments of empires and it assembled them into an economic and then a political space, which allowed those fragments of empires to thrive. So, I mean, Britain as it stands now is a fragment of empire. France, likewise. These are fragments. These are metropolitan fragments of empires. The East European countries, Poland, Hungary, the Baltics, and so on, those are also fragments of empires. They're peripheral fragments of the Habsburg monarchy, the Russian Empire, and then the Soviet Union. But they're all fragments of empires. The historical achievement of the European Union is that it brings fragments of empires together in a way which permits people to live, you know, let's say, decent, dignified lives. But if you don't know why you're successful, if you have a completely different story about why you're successful, like if Bill Gates thought that he was successful, you know, because he's a good carpenter or something, it's unlikely that you're going to be able to maintain that success. And that's the problem that the European Union has now. The problem the European Union has now is that it's challenged on many fronts, including ideologically, and the people who matter don't actually know why it is that they've been so successful. Or to put it in a negative way, when we look at the debates about the future of the European Union, you know, Brexit being the most prominent example, but it's actually typical or hypertypical, what you find is that the friends and the enemies of the European Union share the same story. Their story is there was a war and the nation states learned from the war and the nation states decided to make Europe, which is wrong. Didn't happen, never happened. But because the enemies think that, the enemies of the European Union think that, then they think, well, if the nation state chose to join the European Union, they can also choose to leave. And everybody accepts that. Everybody accepts that. The friends of the European Union also accept that. Right? No one counter-argues by saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, Austria actually never was a particularly successful nation state for a very long time. Britain was never a nation state ever, never happened. France was never a nation state. No one ever counters with that, right? Everybody accepts the same rules of engagement. So the friends of the European Union are pushed back to their myth. And their myth is the blah, 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 pragmatic prosperity, yada, 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 right? It has none of the actual drama of actual European history in it, which is why it loses. Or to put it even more negatively, if the real story of European history is a story of a choice between empire and integration, which it is, what does that mean for little places like England that decide to leave Europe, right? I mean, the English have no other history besides empire and integration. The English have never had to go it alone. There is no useful political memory of England going it alone. England either had an empire or it had Europe. The English were never in a position of having either of those things. What happens if, God forbid, Brexit actually takes place? Northern Ireland goes, Scotland goes, the English are left on their own in the world. There is no choice to have an English nation state, right? There's no magical place where you get to just be alone in the world. You're going to be with empires, but without the European Union around you, right? So it's going to be you v. China, you v. Russia, you v. America, you v. Google, you v. Facebook, you v. Amazon. Amazon may be the most frightening of them. You'll be in a world of empire, but you just won't be an empire anymore.
Well, there are some hard truths there for Britain's pro-Brexit lobby. But doesn't a lot of what you're saying fit with French and British colonial history primarily? West Germany's circumstances, after all, after the Second World War, are just materially so different. Doesn't that mean that they can play a distinctive role in catalysing the integration story? West Germans, after all, had no choice but to give up their empire. That must give them a different perspective on the whole meaning and narrative of European integration.
Yeah, I think that's right. That is to say, the German version of the myth says, we learned as a nation state the good lessons before everybody else, right? That's the German version. We learned the right lessons and we learned them faster than everybody else. And therefore, we are the good supporters of Europe and we're the nice people. But the truth is that what actually happens to Germany, as your question suggests, is a much more intense and compressed version of the whole story of imperial collapse. Germany is behind Britain and France in forming empires, and from the 1890s, in various ways, it's trying to catch up. The Second World War in Europe is in its essence, that is, in the essence of the intentions of the people who bring about the war, right? In Hitler's mind, the Second World War in Europe is precisely a colonial war to create a German empire in the Soviet Union, in particular in Ukraine. It's a colonial war which, in Hitler's mind, is going to allow Germany to catch up to the British Empire and become another power in the world as Hitler sees things, along with the British Empire and the American Empire. That's the balance of power he sees in the future. And so when the Germans lose the Second World War, and naturally, this gives rise to all sorts of stories about what's really going on, and one of them is the EU story. But fundamentally, what's happening is that Europe's perhaps greatest power happens to be the first to decisively, irrevocably, and unarguably lose a colonial war. And that's what makes Germany interesting, because it means that Germany is going to be in the forefront of the process to replace empire with something else, which is what the Schuman Plan is all about, right? I mean, talking to the French about the Second World War is frankly meaningless. The Second World War is not about France, right? The whole gesture of like German-French reconciliation, although of course I'm in favor of it and it's a good thing and so on, and let, you know, Macron and Merkel meet every Saturday, that'll be great. But saying that talking to France is about resolving the problems of the Second World War is meaningless. It's a deliberate misdirection. The Second World War was not about like having enough, you know, coal and steel in the right places. The Second World War was a much vaster aim. The aim was to conquer a good deal of Eurasia so that Germany could be an empire. It wasn't about France. France just had to be gotten out of the way. It was about Ukraine. And so what we see here is that Germany is just a particularly intense version of the general story, which is that Germany is a European imperial power, but it loses quickly, dramatically, horribly, and irrevocably, and therefore German leaders, I mean, quite intelligently, start looking for the thing which is going to replace empire. And the idea that they come up with, quite intelligently, is Europe. But they can't say so. I mean, even the Germans, who are, in general, much better than other Europeans, about trying to do the right thing in curating the past. The Germans make the exact same mistake as everyone else, just more intensely. Because what the European Union story allows you to do, this whole story of nation states who learn from war, yada, yada, the whole thing that story allows you to do is not talk about the colonies, right? So what the European Union story does is that it displaces the history of torturing Algerians and replaces it with the history of Jean Monnet, right? It displaces the history of killing Ukrainian civilians, if you're Germany, and replaces it with the history of the coal and steel community. And on and on and on. If you're Spain and Portugal, it replaces the history of losing your colonies in Africa and replaces it with the history of a democratic transition, which ends in European Union, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same for everybody. But with the Germans, it's just more intense. What the Germans do is they take the Second World War and they forget the aspects of it that are colonial. Right? They do remember the Second World War. They do a better job than anyone else, but they forget the colonial aspects, right? Nobody in Germany talks about, or almost nobody, talks about the Second World War as a colonial war for Ukraine, even though that is what it was. And even though without that assumption, the things that the Germans try to remember, like the Holocaust, actually make no sense. So what the Germans do is the same thing that everyone else does. They use the story of Europe to not look at their own colonial history.
Today, Europe is extremely well known, and we talk about on this show a lot, facing a rise of authoritarian nationalism in many states. How does the account of memory failure that you're describing, this history fallacy of what we take the meaning of the European Union to be, how does this connect with the issues that Europeans are facing when nationalism and far-right politics is on the rise again?
Yeah, I mean, there are different levels. One level is, why is it not surprising, right? So why should we not be surprised or thrown off our guard by the rise of authoritarianism in Europe? You know, and here, Mark Mazower, you know, 20 years ago, wrote a very nice book called Dark Continent, which reminds us that the tradition of democracy and liberalism is actually quite weak in Europe, right? So there's no particular reason for Europeans or Americans, for that matter, to imagine that there's some kind of historical default for democracy, and that, like, if there aren't any other problems, we will automatically fall into democratic or fall into liberal mode. That's just not the way that history works. You know, the second broad point is about globalization, that the last time things went awry, the last time stories of progress didn't turn out, and the last time that, you know, democratic regimes such as they were challenged was the globalization failure in late 19th, early 20th century. You know, this long globalization failure, which includes First World War, Second World War, Soviet Union, Holocaust, and so on. Globalization itself has these kind of perversely dialectical implications, which you just can't get around, right? Like, that it does make some people better off and it does make other people off. It creates an unpredictable capacity for comparison, which people didn't necessarily expect. And you never know who's going to end up comparing whom to whom and who's going to end up feeling like a victim to whom. Globalization also allows an unlimited textual resource for stories of victimization. In our globalization, you can be a victim of, you know, anybody, migrants, refugees, the Jews, the Chinese, like anybody, basically anywhere. If you're Donald Trump, you're a victim of all these things. You know, so globalization creates all these possibilities. And we saw that the first time around, and we're seeing that the second time around. For me, like, the problem with the contemporary European Union is that it's an institution which is built for the future, but its self-justification is all about the past. And that self-justification, as I've tried to write this show, doesn't actually make a whole lot of sense. It's an institution which is built for the future. I mean, unlike a nation state, right? I mean, as soon as, if England becomes a nation state, we can then see if England is built for the future, you know, as Theresa May said at Davos the other year. I don't think so. Maybe I'm wrong. But the European Union is built for the future. The European Union is built to handle the actual problems of the actual future. It's built to handle digital monopoly. It's built to handle climate change, at least up to a point. It's doing better than other people. It's built to handle digital privacy. It's built to handle these things. You know, China handles these things by way of digital authoritarianism. America currently is handling these things by doing some strange kind of, I don't know if it's navel gazing or belly dancing or something, but like, we're doing some strange, you know, performative acrobatics. We're not actually dealing with the problems of the future. The European Union is built for the problems of the future, and to some extent it's handling them, but there's no story about that. The narrators of the European Union don't have a narration which is about the future.
So to what extent do you think Russia is a model case for the authoritarian nationalism happening elsewhere? I felt that this was one of the big takeaways and implications of your analysis in The Road to Unfreedom. You summarise this Russian position at one point as empire for Russia, nation states for everyone else.
Russia gets a lot of attention now. I think the problem is that Russia didn't get a lot of attention when it was building up an alternative model. Our stories, whether European or American, tended to sideline Russia. So Russia, in our stories, is a transition failure. You know, it doesn't fit our categories, therefore it's somehow off on the side of the road. But in fact, what happened in Russia was something different, which is that Russians rather quickly realized that the American story about capitalism bringing democracy wasn't going to work for them. And then a little bit later, they realized the European story of membership was not going to work for them. And they came up with a different idea, or I should say, not Russians, but the handful of men who control most of the wealth in Russia and also who control the state came up with a different story. And their story is, look, you know, the only thing that really matters is money and power. Everything else is kind of a joke. There's no truth. Institutions are a joke. Law's a joke. Democracy is a joke. All those things are just a sham. I think that's a new version of government, a new postmodern version of government. And if you're going to make it work, you have to make it work everywhere. Because if Russians respond to that by saying, well, wait a minute, democracy is not a joke in Britain, or the rule of law is not a joke in America, you have a problem. And so, therefore, what you embark upon is not just propaganda at home to explain to Russians that America and Britain actually are a joke. You do things like you push Brexit, which they did, or you push Trump, which they did, which have the result of making America and Britain look more like a joke. And those are two prominent examples, but that's their foreign policy now, is just to try to dissolve things, to make everything look like a joke everywhere all the time. That's a strategy, right? The business about the nation state for everybody else, that's part of the strategy, because the Russians, of course, know that the nation state is not going to work out for England. That's why they want it for England. They know it's not going to work out, right? They know the nation state isn't going to work out for Belgium or Austria or Poland. They're perfectly aware of that. That's why they want the European Union to break up. I mean, interestingly, when you're outside the European Union, the story that I'm telling is easier to see than when you're inside. I mean, the Russians wouldn't tell it the same way that I would tell it. They would tell it in a less nice way. I mean, they would say that the European Union is doomed because you can't have these things that aren't empires. Either it has to be an empire, it's not going to exist. But they see things in a way which is, I mean, in some sense closer to the way I see things, although it's very unsympathetic because they want to destroy Europe. So Russia has this kind of policy of strategic relativism where, like, they don't aspire to have a lot of power. They know they can't really have a lot of power. What they aspire is for everyone else to have less power. And the way for the European Union to have less power is for it to cease to exist. Now, but in a deeper way, Russia is not so much a model as a warning. I mean, the warning is, this is what politics can look like if wealth gets too concentrated and if you give up on factuality in media, right? That this can actually happen and that it's maybe a little closer than we think. You know, if these Russian operations can work, you know, if they can work vis-a-vis Ukraine, or if they can work in a Dutch referendum or a British referendum or an American presidential election, maybe we're not so far away from all of that. In that sense, this can be a useful warning.
In the book, you spend a little bit of time analysing the fascist Alexander Dugin, who was brought into the inner circle of the Putin regime in the last decade or so from the real outer fringes of Russian politics as a neo-Nazi in the 1990s. What's the significance of Dugin? Many people, for example, have pointed out the parallels between the manifesto produced by the Christchurch attacker, terrible massacre we saw recently, and the ideas that Dugin has been expounding in Russia itself.
Yeah, I mean, rather than making Dugin himself more important than he is, let me try to answer it in terms of some general trends. Mm-hmm. One is that ideas are back, you know, whether we notice or not. I mean, as I see it, there's been a return of fascism at the level of ideology that's been going on for the past 15 years or so, which we have averted our eyes from, partly because we've just convinced ourselves that there are no longer ideas, right? The Europeans and the Americans have different stories, different pragmatic determinist stories about how ideas no longer matter, but we both have these stories, and they prevented us from seeing that there are these people with ideas. And when they do turn up, these people with ideas, we dismiss them as like bearded, bespectacled, you know, not important, they can't be important, right? And there's a certain tone that we use immediately. As soon as someone shows up with ideas, like, well, like that might be interesting, but, you know, of course it doesn't really matter because, of course, Putin is really a pragmatist. Right? Everybody's really a pragmatist. And the everybody's really a pragmatist story, because of our determinism, is supposed to explain how everything's ultimately going to turn out well. Because if everybody only cares about money, well, then they're just like us and they're rational, and eventually that will lead to something good. And in the meantime, it can't lead to anything that's too bad. But it's not true, right? It's just not true that people who accumulate tens of billions of dollars in some invisible, dialectical, transcendental way are actually supporting democracy. That's just not true. If you have tens of billions of dollars, like Mr. Putin, you're probably thinking of ways to explain to the world why that should be and why things can't change. And this version of fascism that we have is very good for that. What this version of fascism does, I think it does what the Marxists said that the first fascism did. I think the Marxists were wrong the first time around. I don't think that fascism in the 20s and 30s was in fact about protecting capital. I don't think that's right. But I think fascism this time around is about protecting capital, and it's too bad that there are no Marxists around to analyze it, because I think this is actually what is happening this time around. Because this time around, I think that is actually what's happening. I mean, I think whether Mr. Putin believes this stuff or doesn't believe this stuff, the fascist revival which he has undertaken in Russia, and he has, I mean, it's not that Russia's a fascist country, I don't believe that, but he has supported real live fascists like Mr. Dugin, who is prominently on the most important Russian media, or Alexander Prokhanov, who's like an old-fashioned, everyday, in-your-face fascist who, you know, is also very much in the center of Russian media, or a very interesting dead fascist called Ivan Ilyin, who Mr. Putin has rehabilitated, revived. What this allows him to do is to tell a story about how things can't change, how this is the way things have to be, that politics is not about policy, but it's about virtue. And then the fascists help to define this extreme story, which has to be extreme, about how all the virtue is on the Russian side. That leads me to the third thing I wanted to say, which is to affirm the end of your question. This stuff works much better on the internet than boring stories of pragmatism do. The conspiratorial friend-enemy stuff fits much better with the way that digital beings, I mean algorithms, process stuff. And so there's now this, you know, vicious cycle between the kind of content that these men are capable of producing and the way the internet actually works. They're also just, as you say, I mean, they are personally connected over the internet, right? There is a Brown International, which there wasn't really in the 20s and 30s. There is now a Brown International. But also the internet itself, in some way, which we don't really like to acknowledge, is kind of on their side.
Well, that's it for those listening on the podcast platforms. Thanks to Tim and thanks to you for listening. The podcast has had a fantastic year, but there's much more to come. To keep it sustainable and to expand, we need your help. That's why we're introducing extra time for paid-up members of Another Europe is Possible. To join the campaign, go to anotheureurope.org/join. In this week's extra time, we asked Tim whether he'd consider himself a European federalist, and whether the rise of political authoritarianism is changing the very structure of capitalism. If you've enjoyed today's show, please leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. It makes a huge difference to our ability to reach new listeners. You can also contact us on podcast@anotheureurope.org with feedback and suggestions for new content. We'll be back very soon. See you then.
Do you think that Europe needs greater political union? Would you, for example, describe yourself as a federalist? There are lots of ideas bandied around on this score. For example, you could be in favour of an economic government for the Eurozone, perhaps a directly elected president, I don't know. I suspect that you're not a federalist, and your argument seems very similar to what Mary Caldor says. She argues that the EU is best seen as a new type of global governance, a new way of doing international politics, rather than a state in the making. In contrast, there are lots of people across Europe that to this day would see themselves as European federalists. For example, Guy Verhofstadt from the Liberal Centre, or Euclid Taskalatos from the Greek Syriza Party, the finance minister. They're on very different parts of the political spectrum, from the neoliberal centre to the radical left, but they would both support, in one way or another, a federal Europe. So where exactly do you stand on this big question that has existed in the politics of the European Union for as long as the project of ever closer union has existed?
I mean, this is, you know, I don't have the kind of expertise that a lot of the people you're citing have. My sense is that, yes, it would be good for Europe to have a greater political profile, but no, federalism is not the way towards that. As a historian, I don't think that the European Union is a state. I think that the European Union is the way that European states survive and thrive. There's a reason why the average European state looks and functions differently than the average American state or the average African state or the average Asian state, if there's such a thing as the average. But there's a reason for that, and that reason is European integration. European integration allows the state to function. Of course, that creates the illusion that it's the state itself which is doing all the work. You know, it's like, for me, it doesn't follow from that. And now we're going to shift from like history to literature, just one's feeling about how the world works. It doesn't follow from that that you would want to do away with the states, because I think Europe also needs the states. The magic of Europe, or the beauty of Europe, or the tolerability of Europe has to do with the fact that it has this variety. It's not that one state is like another state. It's that the states are actually irreducibly different from one another. Like, no one is trying to say that, or no wise person is trying to say that Belgium has to be a version of Italy, or that Finland has to be a version of Poland, or whatever. I don't really think federalism is the way forward. And I don't think it's ever going to happen, by the way. I mean, I think it's politically impossible. But if the idea is Europe should have more of a political profile, then I think absolutely. And on the political economic side, I think a common fisc or something like more fiscal power really makes a lot of sense. I mean, this is what I thought way back in the early 90s when, you know, there were debates about the euro, that I used to be an economist. And, you know, one of the things that I remember from back when I used to be an economist is that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to have monetary policy without fiscal policy. And we saw that after 2008. I think it makes sense to have a bigger fisc, but to have a bigger fisc, you have to have a parliament that people believe in, because people have to pay taxes and believe they're not being exploited. That's the stopping point right now, is that people have to believe in the European Parliament in some other way besides like this May, which is we believe in it because it's either going to doom us or it's going to rescue us. Like, people have to believe in it. And that I think is where things have stalled a little bit, is that not enough people really believe in the European Parliament.
Does the contemporary rise of authoritarianism point to a change in the very structure of capitalism? There does seem to be this rise of oligarchic globalization all over the world that's creating a kind of vicious swarm around us.
I mean, capitalism is a funny beast, because it's hard to say when there was that normal version of capitalism, you know, which is now being distorted. The problem with capitalism, and I say this as somebody who, by the way, like, believes that markets are necessary and that they serve a very useful function, and that we couldn't live the way we live now without markets. I mean, the problem with the word capitalism is that there are no people in it, right? Like, I mean, liberalism has a certain idea of what a person is. A person is free. Socialism has a certain idea of what a person is. A person is together with other people. Capitalism doesn't have any people in it. How do you think normatively about a concept which doesn't actually have any people inside the concept from the beginning? But, you know, that throat clearing aside, I think something has happened since 1989, which is that there has been an intellectual victory by the anti-Keynesians, just as there had been an intellectual victory by the Keynesians before that, and that these intellectual victories have their own histories, which are intellectual histories and have very little to do with the actual world. The victory of the Hayek and especially the Friedman crowd doesn't have anything to do with like their ability to describe the world, which is poor. But it nevertheless happened, right? And it was happening coinciding with 89. And what happened after 89 is that we made this fateful deterministic mistake, which is to say that like their determinism is wrong, therefore our determinism is right. Right. Whereas the correct answer to 89 was, oh, determinism is, turns out not to be true. But almost nobody said that. I mean, our triumphant response was, their determinism is wrong, ours is right. Even though ours is a lot like theirs. I mean, theirs says capitalism has to lead to socialism, and ours says capitalism has to lead to democracy. I mean, those look like pretty close cousins, actually. And if one of them is wrong, you might want to think, maybe this whole family is illegitimate. But that's a mistake that was made. And it was made at a time, you know, when this Friedman idea of the world, or this Thatcher-Reagan idea of the world, was winning. And then there's the empirical point, which is just about inequality. And of course, there are important debates by smart people about why it's happening. But American wages have been stagnant since some point in the 70s. In inequality, especially of income, but especially of wealth, in my country, but also in other places, has changed in a way which I think now is qualitative, right? Like, at some point, these quantitative changes become qualitative, where some people are no longer living in the same world as other people. I mean, moving towards your question, that is a big problem for democracy, because, of course, this whole idea of the middle class and how everybody's in the middle class is always going to have a little bit of fuzziness around the edges. But now it's kind of, the edges are now too much, and like there's just too much line to say that like in Britain there's a middle class, or in the US there's a middle class. It just takes too much mendacious effort now to say these things. And when people aren't living in different worlds, that means they can't really talk to each other, right? So like Americans, I'm just going to speak from experience, can't understand how much money some people have because it's just like out of the range of what most people, you know, could grasp, right? Like the difference between a million and a billion, you know, in real life is a huge thing, but that people actually could have $1 billion or multiple billions of dollars, it's just hard to grasp what that would mean, you know, when you're paying off your college debts, or which is a kind of elite case, or, you know, when you're just trying to make your rent payment or whatever. But I mean, more prominently, like the people who then have the power also just have no idea what life is like for everybody else. And, you know, whether they care or not, they just have no idea. So we end up in this world where the political space is taken up by projects like, you know, colonizing Mars or putting your brain in a jar or building a platform in the Pacific, as opposed to the things that we actually need to do. You can't really have civil society based on conversation with these kinds of levels of inequality. And these kinds of levels of inequality also kill the future, because inequality means no social advance. And this is true in the US, right? I mean, the American dream is possible in a lot of places right now, just not in a lot of America. Without social advance, you don't believe in the future. If you don't believe in the future, then you get caught up in these stories of how things used to be great and how it's somebody else's fault that they're not great. And that's an authoritarian story. But the big practical thing at the bottom of all this is tax fraud. I mean, legal and illegal tax fraud. It's become normal that the actually existing shrinking challenged middle classes pay taxes, but the very rich do not pay taxes, that's becoming normalized. I mean, so much of what is wrong with the world could be fixed if that were fixed. You know, unfortunately, although it sounds too simple to be true, that has a really direct effect on politics, because somebody like Donald Trump only exists because of that form of capitalism. Donald Trump simply cannot exist if Russians can't anonymously move money to shell companies and buy his property in the second half of 2016, which they did. The Trump-Russia thing is like, it's so neat that it's almost suspicious. How could it be so simple that just dodging taxes and having anonymous companies allows something like this to happen? But that's basically how it can happen. I mean, this is a direct threat to democracy, because you're not sovereign if money flows that you can't follow from people who have already rejected the rule of law because they don't pay taxes are what ends up determining who are your candidates.
Thanks to Tim, and thanks to our members for listening. And remember to leave that rating or review on the platforms to help us grow. See you next time.